What's better than earning money from a 9-to-5 job? It's earning money while you sleep, which is made possible if you start investing. You're listening to the Real Estate Investing Demystified with your very own dynamic duo, Ava Benesaki and August Biniez. Tune in as we discuss everything real estate, both on the passive and active sides. We feature life-changing stories of today's real estate leaders that will help build your own roadmap to success. This is a show that will lead you to a diversified portfolio, a much bigger revenue, and a next-level venture that brings you a smooth cash flow. Let's get this episode started. All right, welcome back to the Real Estate Investing Demystified show, everybody. Hope you're having a great week so far.
Absolutely.
It's February 1st today, so happy February.
Happy February, everyone. So we're excited to be back here, and we have an exciting show. We have an exciting guest on our podcast, on our YouTube show. And I mean, this is a conversation that I always talk a lot about to myself, to others, to you, about life and health and longevity and all this great stuff. So that's the conversation we're going to have today. So it's a bit of a deviation from our usual show, which is about investing and real estate and all sorts of economic kind of items. So yeah.
And the reason we're bringing Daniel on the show is we always say this, okay, you can build as much wealth as you want, but honestly, if you don't have your health, you really have nothing, right? You can't enjoy your wealth. And I really believe that health comes first. I'm really passionate about everything that we're going to talk about today. So I'm really excited to dive into things and get some tips from Daniel.
And also we see a lot of people that have been tremendously successful in business and what have you, but it was at a cost of their well-being, their health, mental health. So this idea of, hey, you can have all the money in the world, but you can't get to enjoy it. That's really the question here, right? So longevity, health, the mobility, these are all very important. And it's not about how long you live, but how you also get there. You could live to be 90 years old, but if the last 20 years you were bedridden and you couldn't really do anything,
that's right.
Did you really live? So those are the conversations we're going to be having today. We're excited.
Yeah, we're really excited. We think that this hour conversation that we're going to have with Daniel, you know, this tiny sliver of all the information we're going to be giving is an attempt to enrich our lives, our family's lives, our audience lives, our friends' lives by discussing this topic. So a little bit about Daniel, guys, a little bit about our guest. We're actually joined by Daniel Taushan. He holds a graduate degree from the University of British Columbia in stem cell biology with a Bachelor of Science in General Biology. So he worked in research in the molecular profiling of exercise, looking into comprehensive blood panels in search of biomarkers for predictive health analytics with Molecular U and UBC's School of Kinesiology to develop methods for biological age calculation. So with a love for education and working directly with people, he stepped away from academics. He then launched Timeline Sciences to put you on the timeline aligned with your unique genome and goals. So welcome, Daniel. We're really excited to have you on the show today.
Thank you, guys. Yeah, pleasure to be here today.
For sure. And last point is we always have this, of who do we believe this interview is helpful to? And it's usually this person or this demographic, but this interview is helpful for everyone.
That's right.
So great.
Yeah, this will bring great value to everybody. So listen up, guys. We have an expert here today. Let's start diving into things. Daniel, first question, if you could share a bit about your personal journey in exploring the science of longevity and what motivated you to become an expert in this field?
I mean, there was never a motivation for knowing longevity per se. The longevity was a consequence as to being absolutely stuck with cellular underpinnings of life. We have this humongous organism that's comprised of 30 to 70 trillion cells. That's a lot of different cells doing a lot of different things. And that is really the key interest that I've had since I was born. Probably the moment I can start talking, kept asking, what happens if you keep zooming in? If you keep going further and further, what do you get to eventually? And so my parents told me, well, stop talking. That's enough out of you. You know, like there's, you know, you get to nothing. You know, just leave it alone. And it's sort of that curiosity that's kind of driven me to from the athletic pursuits. Hey, what supplements to take? How do I get faster? How do I get stronger? What's better recovery? To then going towards the medical and science fields and discovering that everything comes back to the cell. We'll talk about longevity in a few different aspects, but there's the cellular determinants. So how well can the cell do? And then there's the physiological components, right? All these cells are working together to give you a heart rate, to give you lung function. And so if the cellular determinants aren't where they need to be, if they're at a cap, that's going to be a clear determinant of how long you live. But they could be completely fine, but you can have a stroke or a heart attack. So the physiology there wasn't being upkept. So those are sort of the two balances for longevity that I break it up into. So we can address if there's risks for the physiology But then what are the cells telling us? How do we do the best for the cell? And the secrets in the cell also are a little bit of a window into our history on this planet. And though we get to live about 100 years or so, plus or minus, we really don't have access to what happened 10,000 years ago. But human beings are here. And so how do we connect with that ancestry? It is a lot through what's happening in the cell. It's the genetic memory that we're carrying on today.
So Daniel, considering the vast amount of information on longevity, what do you believe are the key factors that significantly contribute to a longer and healthier life? And I'm sure everybody wants to hear.
I like you through asked it in terms of belief, because there are things I do believe and there's things that I can clearly articulate that I know. And I think that's a very important distinction to make today as science is becoming more muddled and used in business rather than just the science being the science, something you can go back to and build from. And so I'll start then with the knows, what I do, what I know. And I mean, the first one and the most obvious one, I think, in today's age is your nutrition and fasting, right? Unsurmountable evidence for that there needs to be a portion of the day where you're not eating. And then what you're eating needs to complete the nutrients that you require to live on this planet. That's a must. Number two, mood and temperament. So, I mean, the word to remember is laughter, right? Those who laugh more throughout their day live longer. Even if they have terrible blood profiles, if they have a certain temperament, they seem to outlast and outlive. Now, you can also have the negative, like you can be a very angry person, but they'll get you maybe further than the guy who's apathetic, but then won't get you as far as the person that's in a better state of mind. And then sleep and naps. So the key thing to take away from the sleeps, it's linked in with the circadian rhythm. So sun rises, you rise. The 8 hours of sleep a day is very, it's sort of a misdirection. It doesn't necessarily matter how many hours of sleep you get if you're sleeping from 6 a.m. to 2, 3 in the afternoon. That's not going to do you any good. And so rise with the sun, you go to bed on time that's adequate for your chronobiology. Mm-hmm. And so that's key. And the people that tend to outlive the rest of us, they nap during the day. So they wake up in the sun, wake up with the sun, if not before, and then they take a short nap, 20, 30 minute nap. And they can take a nap while they're sitting, right? So that's a skill that some people can develop. The fourth one is cold exposure. And so if you guys have ever heard of Bergman's rule, have you guys heard of Bergman's rule?
No, we haven't.
No, we haven't.
So it's an eco-geographical rule of how the same type of species or family of related animals is going to be bigger the more you go towards the poles. So you know, take a look, the emperor penguin, the biggest penguin. It's in the coldest region of the planet. And so the more you go towards the warmer parts of the planet, the smaller the respective species that's related to that clad is. And so cold is an incredible stimulus for the organism. We have to function in sort of this, like a thermal equilibrium for our enzymes to function. And the cold makes it so that our body is able to rise to that challenge.
Now, there's a difference. Polar bear are the biggest bears, right? Like we were just mentioning. So interesting. I was just thinking.
Exactly. The largest land carnivore, devastating, very scary. Yeah, and grizzlies are humongous. That's terrifying. Polar bear is just like one notch up, right? And so the cold is something that's also irreplaceable. And it's very interesting biology with the human being in comparison to other animals and how our cells are able to deal with the cold. We have something special because almost every single cell has a way to interact with the cold, whereas other, like a mouse, will be restricted in the tissues. And then the last one, and I'll be very careful the way I say it, so I don't give it the wrong impression, is these case studies in where you have individuals reaching 100 years old. They have a distilled liquor, and they're not slamming it. They're taking a thimble size amount a day that they use as a digestive, right? And so that's another component that seems to rise up to help individuals make it further and further, because digestion is an expensive process. And if you can aid that process anyway, then that's going to help you be able to do it more and more and more. And then, you know, the question is like, where's the exercise in this? How come on the top five exercise doesn't come into it? And the reality is walking is good enough. If you just walk, you can easily make it to 100, no problem. Now you're going to have a quality difference. The person that has been actively stimulating their muscles and going through the stressor of loading weight across their joints, when it comes to the 60s, 70s, 80s, well, mobility is huge. And it doesn't feel good to have a restricted movement. And so that aspect of quality of life is very meaningful. It's also meaningful for social engagements that you're capable of participating in. It's also what you can do for others. There's a benefit for the exercise. But in just in terms of longevity standards, like, hey, I want to make it to 100, you got to walk.
Yeah. Okay. And what were those five again?
It was diet, sleep, temperament, and then cold and digestion, correct?
Yes. Yeah.
Okay, amazing. And I really want to actually dive into each one and break them down a little bit, because there's a lot of questions on my mind that are a lot of things that are coming top of mind. So let's break each one of those down, starting with diet.
Let's do it. Let's do
Okay.
it.
The diet, I mean, historically, it was like the enemy was fat, right? And then now the enemy is sugar. It kind of became sugar. There's lots of discussions about the Mediterranean diet and then the keto diet, which I made August go on when we first met. And then there's a carnivore diet, which we actually tried for a little bit as well. And we were really excited about how we felt. Is there a diet that's like best for us humans? Go ahead and talk to, you
Yeah,
had your friend
I mean, my
John.
good friend John Carden, rest in peace, he would always say that this thing he would always say that every animal on the planet knows what's their exact diet, except humans. We don't know what our diet is. We're still searching to figure out our diet. So
And it can be really confusing out there, right? And then alongside with diet, you were mentioning fasting. So let's kind of talk about, I was reading a book and it said, eat fat in the morning, eat carbs at night. Like there's just so many things and it's hard to test it and figure out what's best for us. So talk to us a little bit about that, Daniel, if you don't mind. And I understand that each person is different. So it might be a different theory for each person.
that's a hard question, because the easy overarching answer is that how easy it is, but it is the diet that you have adapted to, or the diet that your lineage has adapted to. Now, there's a very critical time point for about 3 weeks when you're born, where your microbiome is being not solidified, but it's finding its balance within your system. And it comes on very early on in age. And mom has the most influence over what our microbiome is going to be. And so based off of our lineage of what our ancestor ate, plus what mom gives us at a very early on, decides what nutrients are going to be easiest for us to deal with in the coming year or so as we start exploring the foods that are available to us. And so as a human being, we are a little bit bizarre because we can eat almost anything. And because of that, it's made it so that we're in this guessing game of what's good for you, what's not. And there's a very clear, from the physiology standpoint, path is fat is incredibly healthy. So if a person is very fat, another way to think about it is that their genetic system for incorporating fat, their lipogenesis, is phenomenal. It's working extremely well. But obviously, it's going to come as a consequence to other parts of their health. And so is there this idyllic diet, like the keto diet? And one thing I've realized is that if everything was wrong, it would be easy to figure it out. But because there's a little bit of truth in all of it, it keeps people sometimes going down really erroneous paths before someone comes to and introduce them. Well, do you know that keto refers to ketosis? It's a metabolic state, and you can eat whatever you want and still be in ketosis. And you're like, well, no, carbohydrates kick you out of ketosis. And for those maybe that are not familiar, if you eat carbohydrates, you will stop this metabolic process of producing ketones. That's what ketosis is referring to. You're producing this energy resource that's a ketone, but it's also a signaling molecule. And so if you eat a carbohydrates, your liver stops this enzyme and inhibits the enzyme, and you're no longer producing ketones. But if you eat one meal a day, then within 8 hours, you're going to be back to producing ketones. So then technically, you're in this state of metabolic flexibility, which I advocate for heavily as a way of maintaining health. And you didn't have to eat just avocados and bacon or just eat meat. You could have eaten some lentils, you could have eaten the beans, and then you could have gotten back to ketosis. And
Interesting.
That is very interesting because I mean, we wouldn't have known that because
Yes.
we thought carbs right away would
Well, we
be.
thought that keto diet with intermittent fasting was like the best way of going about doing things, but
But I love that you just kind of laid it out there. You're like, hey, listen, you can eat whatever you want in that meal. And so as long as you're fasting, you can still get your ketosis back.
absolutely. Yeah. And exercise will get you there faster. So
Okay.
if you eat a meal and then decide what I'm going to go and do some endurance training, it'll take you about an hour to two to of continuous exercise, which is not fun. It could be, I guess, if you're that type of guy, but it'll take you about an hour or two before your blood will start producing ketones again, and you can detect blood in endurance athletes within that short time frame.
So a couple
But
questions, Daniel, just to break things down a little bit more.
yeah.
You mentioned eating one meal a day, correct?
Yeah, I mean that is an option,
That it's an
right? I
option.
think,
So with
yeah.
that option, I'm just curious, would that be morning, night, afternoon, or is it just depend on each person, or it doesn't really even matter? And should somebody work out after they eat to then refuel their body, or is it better to work out before you eat before you work out?
Right. Those are great questions, and it does depend on an individual specific and how they have adapted.
Yes.
If you are eating one meal a day, generally what's kind of considered the ideal time would be somewhere between 4 and 5 as this idyllic window for having your that one meal. And then it's not just you're eating a plate, you're eating like an hour's worth of food. You're sitting down, you might have fruit to start, you take a little time, then you might have a salad of sorts, then you might have another couple of dishes. It's a ritual that you then participate in. And tell me again, so we had that as a question, and then the specifics was
eating before or after you work out.
Workout. So there's an aspect in which you can train the system to say, I'm going to put myself to high exertion and I won't eat till the next day. And so that might suck for about a month for a person that hasn't done that, but eventually they will adapt. And when they adapt, there might be great benefits that come with that. There also might be a limitation. And so we know this from the scientific community, because there's plenty of athletes, bodybuilders, that will have one meal a day, that have a very restrictive, it's a majority plant-based diet, and they continue to keep gaining mass and strength, even though they have these large windows of not eating. And so even though it's easier, if you say, hey, I want to get big, then yeah, you have to eat more. There's different ways to go about doing it. And really, the person is a testament to what they can achieve with it. And there's ways of being nice with the biology, you know, nice to your, kind to yourself. And there's ways to, you know, be like a caveman where, like, I'm just going to brute force it. Usually that's going to come with a lot more like aches and pains and problems than working with someone that has some understanding of the biochemistry to help facilitate maybe an ease in that transition. And for the majority of poor individuals, it is ideal to do the strength exercise, wait a little bit, and then have your food. And it's like there's a mythological 20-minute window. Like, sure, you can get some electrolytes in you, like a coconut water or lemon water or whatever, to help you refuel and recover. But it's best to treat that meal that's coming afterwards as a ritualistic process where you try and make your digestion easy to assimilate the food. That will have a bigger impact long-term than this, I need a 20-minute window, or I need to pump up beforehand. There's a psychological aspect where people like having stuff beforehand because it's satiating, it's pleasurable, and then they go participate in exercise. But from a lot of the high competitive athletes, if they have a competition early in the morning, they're going to have something very simple as the pre-food, like fruit. They won't even touch a muffin. I've met athletes like, nah, I don't want to. It's going to cause me to cramp. So there's a lot to it.
Just to break down the diet. So number one, it's what recommendation kind of in your research and in your studies, what you're saying is kind of that it doesn't have to be one particular type of food like keto or carnivore. It can be a diverse different types of food, one meal a day, and some form of fasting is recommended. And then knowing what your ancestral background is and what type of foods you have more tendencies to work with, that makes more sense. Now, there's one aspect that I always kind of talk about is that I believe that when civilization started 10,000 years ago, it possibly goes back 40,000 years ago, that factory farming was not really there and food was in a way scarce in small civilization that we lived in when cities started and what have you. And kind of then religion gets involved in this idea of preserving food. So being a vegetarian was a big plus. So you have the largest populated countries in the world, China and India, but they're both really Hinduism and Buddhism. They both just eat vegetables and don't eat animals, because if you eat everything around you, there's nothing left. So is there a part of this idea of being vegetarian kind of a way to control people and tell them what to eat, what not to eat idea? Touch on that a bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah, absolutely. First, I'm on a 2-meal-a-day plan, right? 1 meal a day would be great. Some days I do hit the 1 meal because I'm simply not hungry in the morning and I'll avoid the fruit that I normally eat. But that's a phenomenal question. But thank you for that, by the way. I love the insight there. Out of a case study, for example, a lady in India, she has rice, lentils, and about 30 spices. And she's, from last I looked in the case study, she was 104. So that kind of tells you right away. It's like, well, that was enough for her to go. And as far as meat goes, the evidence right now currently is landslide in the favor of it's good for your health, right? And obviously that's going to be the case when you take a look at ecologically, where every single plant that exists needs to defend itself. And so funny enough, plants actually have a bigger genome than a human being, right? When we were uncovering genetics, we thought, oh, we're going to be so complex. We're going to be on top of the food chain in terms of how many genes we're going to have. It turns out rice has got more than double the size of the human genome. And when we start exploring this more and more, it has some now credence where like, okay, well, this thing is stuck in its spot. And it has to defend itself from so many pests that we can't even consider. It has to create all these molecules to protect itself from being eaten, from telling fungus, hey, don't touch me yet, from insects, you're not supposed to eat me, produce cyanide. So at the right time that if the insect does, it'll learn. And so when an animal eats and processes that hard to digest plant, it's doing the work for you. So now it's easier to assimilate the animal in some regards than it is the plant. But not everyone needs to eat the exact same thing. That's, I think, the big takeaway message. Like where you are within your life stage, like if you're a growing baby, you're going to want milk. If you're a young kid, I would think you'd want a lot of meat. You don't have to have the meat, but if you do, it'll be easier because maybe the plant sources aren't as easy accessible for you at the time. And now comes the point where, for me personally, I don't like the factory farm style of support because there's just a lot of suffering that happens to the animals. And though people would like that separation from it, there's that animal has that emotional life that it's lived, it present in its meat as well. So when we eat that, we have to break that down and assimilate it because there's so much conservation in terms of what's in an animal that's, well, any mammal is going to be very similar to what's in us, right? So we're very much similar to, and if you're eating that, that's something similar, you might have these same molecules that now get incorporated into yourself with slight little different twists.
But when we hunted these animals, don't they go through the stress when they're getting hunted and they get scared? Or was this, you mean kind of being stuck in certain area, like, what is it called? Like you can't
enclosure.
Really.
Enclosure. Yeah, you're in enclosure for the entirety of the creature's life. It's being force fed, let's say soy pellets. Those soy pellets are now in high extreme to it. The animal's stressed, not during its hunting, right? Like an acute stress response is great. That's like a healthy, thriving system. But a chronic stress response that's just perpetually there, it causes the system to deteriorate. And so if you hunt an animal, the animal is not stressed all the time. The animal doesn't know. It's experiencing probably bliss for the vast majority of its existence. If it's an antelope, it's bouncing up and down. It looks happy. When it has to run away from a predator, sure, yeah, it gets away even happier. Ha ha, I beat you. So there's a game, obviously, that's being played of hide and seek within nature. And you can taste the difference in game meat, the meat that you hunt. There's a big, massive difference in taste. And so it tells you right away there's something different there, you know, chemical composition. So, I mean, not to pull out things, because the science isn't solved by any means. We're not there yet because we're in the process of uncovering really what that means. But even the factory farm meat does seem to be good enough in some health instances. Though you might be exposed to maybe more hormones than were normally exposed, but there might be some antibiotics that might damage your lining, your gut. My textbooks that I went through for liver, for hepatology, they teach you through detoxification pathways through these chlorophyll molecules that come from plants. There's barely anything that tells you, hey, if you just flush the system with high amounts of protein, what happens? We have an idea on other aspects of what happens when you flush the system with high amounts of protein. But the fact is people have had chronic conditions that they've dealt with for 40 years, switched to a heavy, heavy meat diet. It's like meat and fruit. And they've reversed chronic conditions in which that they've been battling since they were teens. And so those stories to me are a testament to really to spend a little more time and examine what's in front of us. And to say, hey, you're not allowed to eat meat is a little bit ridiculous. But I do think that there's an important societal, cultural responsibility that we just go around perpetuating suffering unnecessarily, right? Like have better farms, heritage farms, more farming that's not just clear cut your land. And like I'm trying to get max profit out of it. There needs to be some type of separation for this where people recognize like we want to support this. We don't want to let this go run astray and like runaway style economics. Yeah. I mean that'd be my two cents on it.
Got it. I think we'll touch on another subject here.
All right. So the next topic was sleep. And now everybody's always heard like you need your 8 hours of sleep or else you're doomed. And that's how you live longer.
Daniel touched on it a bit.
I know.
So it's not about the hours you sleep. It's about when you sleep it. And we always hear about people that work night shifts, they end up getting more heart disease and other issues. So
Right, so Daniel, there's no particular amount of hours that somebody needs to sleep. Is that correct?
Absolutely. I mean, what you ate the day will determine how much sleep you'll need. So if you eat something that needs a lot of digestion, like heavy digestion, you'll sleep more. Your body will ask you to sleep more. Whether you actually sleep more or not depends on disciplined you are.
Okay, very cool. And I just love the fact that with science back, Daniel's saying that naps are a very healthy thing, right? Because a 20-minute nap, some people can't really take them. They're like, I can't nap at all. Myself, I haven't taken a nap in a while because we have a newborn baby and there's not really much time in the day. But you mentioned a 20-minute nap, you can really rejuvenate yourself and then wake up and...
Absolutely. I think we don't know the molecular mechanism at this point. All we can do is the associations. We got the observations down. Yep. But that's at least there's something going on. And so when a person does go to sleep or even just powers down, it allows the system to clean up a little bit.
Right.
Right. So like while we're active doing things, you can't do the cleaning or the reparative kind of mechanisms. But as soon as you power down for a bit, that allows a little bit of a shift in your metabolism. And that seems to be good enough in order to keep yourselves happy and healthy for years to come.
Got it. And let's touch on the sleep a bit more. But personally, I've slept sometimes for 10 hours and I still felt tired. And sometimes I sleep much less and I feel much more energy. Mm-hmm. And this idea of REM sleep that we always hear about as well. Maybe touch on that a bit, if you don't mind.
Yeah. So REM sleep is super cool. So one of my favorite pieces of information to share so that people have almost this like secret insight into REM is that what you can do is you can do something called the astronaut sleeping program, and you can condense your REM cycle into a very short amount of time so that if you only slept for 2 hours, you're still experiencing 5 cycles of REM. And so the way the astronauts do it is that they take off 5 minutes every 2 weeks, regimented. And then eventually it comes down, because you don't want the astronaut sleeping in space. Like, it's like you're up there, you got to make use of it. And there's sort of ticking time clock because you're not meant to be in space. Your body's peeing out calcium in ridiculous rates. Your heart is going to have a really hard time when you come back on Earth if you stay up there too long. And so the sleep component is key because we like the comfy beds. That might be not good for us, right? The fact that you're in a very comfy bed that it's hard to get out of might make it actually harder for circulation and other kind of components, which might exacerbate, hey, I slept for 8 hours, 10 hours, but I still don't feel rejuvenated. But there's another component of, was the sleep restful? And so if there's things that are agitating mentally, you can have a not restful sleep. And there's this science that's emerging called chronobiology, chrono referring to time. And it really, each person will change how much sleep they need throughout time. I was very lucky where as a young kid, my mom, if I wanted to sleep, she'd let me sleep and miss class. And then I'd come to school and I'd make up the work. I always got good grades. So she never really had a problem with it. But I trained and then I wouldn't get to bed till very late. And so she let me sleep. And man, could I sleep as an athlete. But as soon as I stopped exercising, as soon as I stopped eating these heavy meals, I get away with 6.5 hours of sleep and I'm up and at them. And the other part to sleep is there something that you're rising for with a purpose? If you're waking up to something with a purpose, you got a meeting, you got an airplane to catch, you got a competition, you're excited to see someone, you're going to go surfing. Man, is it easy to get up.
Ava says this all the time because, you know, sometimes we have a big project or regular day, it's kind of hard to get up. But if I have to go skiing, I'm up at 4:30 in the morning,
jumping out of bed. I'm like, you have it in you. This is amazing.
But keep going, Daniel.
And that phenomenon there is something that's very hard to study. And it's something that's in the psychological studies often you have to ignore. You can't really incorporate that in. But there's a psychic component. You know, also, it's intimately linked with longevity, right? Like, is there something you're rising for with a purpose? And it doesn't have to be this grand enlightenment or any kind of, but it could be as simple as weaving a basket. You're going to go in the morning, you're going to weave a basket. The basket is going to get circulated through your community. That is purpose. And so the Okinawans, a lot of the case studies that show that there's a 104-year lady that's coming out and she's weaving baskets, but that's what she's looking forward to doing a day. And people love her baskets. And so the sleep aspect to it is key because no matter where you go on the planet, your rhythm tunes to the sun. The circadian rhythm is this important aspect in which there's no deviation from it. And if the moment you do, problems start to rise, then you need to get back to it. And the body tries to communicate as best you can to the conscious part, right? To our scanning radar that for some reason people love associating to. You think like, oh, doesn't matter. The rest of me is not important. What's important is this conscious part. But can the conscious part come into awareness of like, okay, well, I ate a lot of bread and I slept for 9 hours. I took bread out of my diet for 3 days. I'm already down to 8 hours. And people will see that if they take things out of their diet, if they fast for 2-3 days, if they do a 3-day fast, they'll notice how on the third day when they sleep, that one, they might have difficulty getting to sleep because they have so much energy, or two, they might wake up like hours before their alarm. We're like, what am I supposed to be doing now? And that's nice because then it kind of gets the person coming back into, what do I want to do? What did I come here to do? Because you clearly came to do something.
Wow, that's really interesting.
Let's talk about also, is it important to be regimented as far as if you are going to sleep at dusk or around that time, waking up at dawn? So let's say you're going to sleep at 9 p.m., waking up at 6 a.m. type of thing. Should that be consistently the same time? Should that time be moved? Is that in any way, you seen any research on that or you understand? Yes.
Almost the vast majority of us like pattern. We like so that our biology can get into a set of expectations. And we're doing this constantly. So if you eat 3 meals a day, you will secrete a hormone called ghrelin before you need to eat, almost idyllic. And when you've had this regimented time, and it'll take you about 7 to 21 days to shift that hormonal response. And so similar with sleep, for all of us, nobody likes, our liver doesn't like food past around 8 o'clock, not 7, 8 o'clock. So if you're still eating heavy meals after 8, you're making it difficult for your liver, which means every single day you're just pushing how much it has to deal with detoxifying your system. And if you don't sleep between 10 to 2, those are the most critical time points for the liver to detoxify, between 10 p.m. and 2 a.m., then you're constantly pushing it so that it has to deal with it another day and another day and another day and another day. And then all of a sudden, somewhere within the 30s, 40s, and 50s, these autoimmune conditions come up, you know, or inflammatory processes come up. And we can try and start treating the immune system or start treating the symptoms. But ultimately, it comes back to the fact that we haven't lived in concordance with the circadian rhythm. And we absolutely do like discipline and routine. However, there is always this notion of once we have a good routine set up, well, sometimes what we like to do is we like to do weird things as human beings where we get together, we stay up for an entire night, maybe we make a fire and we dance and we chant, we put on music, we bang things. And that also then, it's okay to do these things. You don't have to live a hermit lifestyle where you're not, because you can consider it the same way within this idea of acute versus chronic stress or response to it, is that you've lived a really good life. And now when you have this cool event that you participated in, it's also beneficial, right? Your system isn't so fragile and so weak that it can't handle this. Rather, it rises to the challenge and it absorbs it. And so there's, I'd say for the most part, yeah, we have a lot of discipline.
Amazing. Amazing. All right, let's get to the next pillar.
Temperament. Temperament. I love it. I've been hearing this my whole life. If you laugh a lot, you're going to live longer. And I've, you know.
If you have more friends, you know, you communicate, you're going to live longer.
That's right. If you have more friends, you're going to live longer. Good thing I have a husband who makes me laugh a lot. Thank you. But let's talk about this a little bit, if there's anything to really break down here.
I mean, you two sort of hit the two major points. So the temperament comes also with the social contact. And the people around you, you're going to resemble five most closest people around you.
Yeah.
And we keep each other in check in a lot of ways. And so by nature of having this environment, which is very, it makes it comfortable to share. You're laughing. There's you're not wasting your mental space. Rather, there's looking ways how to have more fun in the day. And for whatever reason is that has a certain type of neurochemistry in which makes it so that it's brimming in terms of the inside of the cell. And I don't have the actual, let's say the heavy duty science to, you know, it's figured out, because it's clearly not. This chemical soup that's happening in the brain that people are, for some reason, if you say neurotransmitter and a synapse, they take it as that's good enough. But the complexity that's happening there is absolutely absurd. And there's a lot more to it than just simply the synaptic sort of transmission. And I don't know exactly what it is, but I would say there's something to do with that connection of there's a thirst for fun. There's a thirst for excitement. There's a thirst for life in which puts the person in a state for what I would consider it possibly, maybe this is coming very, if you can look at the cell, there's like a little stream inside the cell. It's called cytoplasmic streaming. Now, I would wonder if someone's laughing in a positive state, if you were able to examine the cell at the time when they're happy and they're laughing, is the stream just like roaring through there? Or is it faster? There is some kind of physical manifestation of it. What it is, I don't know.
Well, you touched on it also as far as kind of waking up in the morning. If you have something to do and you're adding value and what have you, you're more energetic to get up. That could also be, you just want to live longer if
of
you're
course,
there and
yeah.
you're doing something that you're enjoying and you're feeling fulfilled and what have you. So yeah, the mental part of it is tremendous. Any other points you want to touch on that topic before we move to the next one?
I mean, if someone is in a like negative downward spiral, I would just say careful not to put too much of your energy in that individual, right? Like misery loves company is a saying, and there's a reason it's a saying. And you do have to let the person find their path, right? That's been something that's quite a challenge for my end as I seek to offer services to help people. Sometimes someone needs to hit rock bottom before they snap out of it. Like they're actively searching, how far can I push my physiology? Well, how bad can it get? And often when they do hit the bottom, they're a very good testament to then bring positivity around it. So careful of allowing people to go through their journey that they need to go through.
Okay, colds. This is a great topic. A lot of people are like buying these machines that they're putting on their...
Including our director of acquisition, Paul Hopkins, who keeps sending videos to me that he's cold plunging. And
yeah,
his,
he's cold plunging every single morning.
Well,
he's
cold yes, plunging. He's incredible. But talk about cold plunging. We've actually cold plunged with Daniel
That's
together
right. we have.
Back home. Yeah, so
yeah.
So talk to us about the cold. I mean, when you were talking about the cold earlier, when you talked about the five pillars that you were discussing about longevity and health, when you talked about cold and how certain animals that live in the colder climates, they're larger or what have you, I thought about how do we incorporate that into our lives currently? Because we live in Florida now, you know, moving from Vancouver, which was colder. Does that mean we're going to live less? I mean, particularly Florida, people live longer here. I'm not sure what the reason is, but talk to us about that. Is it cold as a shock that you can bring in when you need it? Is it people that live in colder climates live longer? Yeah, give us your thesis on this whole
thing.
My family's going to love this because, I mean, I grew up in Alberta and my family just sent me a picture the other day. It was minus 38 degrees Celsius. And I was like, oh my God.
But your dad has never felt the cold. He's always inside the car, inside his office, inside home. So he's never really felt that shock.
Right.
So
you feel it when you're gassing up, right? You kind of feel it when you're, but you don't definitely don't spend a lot of time outside. But let's
You're very curious to hear about this song. Yeah, I wasn't even expecting this one. So go ahead.
Right. So, I mean, there's a big difference between the individual experience of their life and this population genetics that has over time of a species evolving and what it likes. So if you want to go live in a very cold environment, you have to deal with it all the time. And if as a human being, which we like warmer temperatures, it's easier to live in warmer temperatures. Food grows in warmer temperatures. There's food's plentiful in the warmer temperatures. And you go to India, you throw a seed down, it starts growing. And so there's that challenge of, okay, if I go into this northern part of the climate, can I survive there? And so there is the Norwegian, the northern part of Europe, as well as the Iceland. They've showcased to us that you can still, even after you've lived there for generations, have a centurion in that population. So there's the adequate amount of preparation. So there's an understanding of food preservation, and there is the adequate amount of nutrition that person needs to survive. And so they are dealing with the cold in a chronic condition. It's always all the time. But they also have that this absolutely ludicrous idea, well, I'm going to go in there and bathe in the ice water because I don't have a shower and I want to clean up. And so what that does too is it also stimulates their system to have a lot better of a response to the chronic cold. And we go now to where you guys are at. Cold is a luxury. Now, if you can provide cold for yourself, that would be phenomenal because you use it in that regard. You would use it as an acute stressor so that the system then can experience this stress and then grow from it. Now, what it does on a cellular level, which is very interesting, and careful anytime you look up the science, that anything that's good for you, you will notice how quick publications come up to say like, oh, no, there's nothing to see here, right? You take a look at the resveratrol, and you look up resveratrol, everything's like trying to tell you how this isn't effective, how many studies found effective. We can talk about that later.
Yeah, we're going to get into that.
I mean, there's reasons why the business side of things does that. But so the human being, maybe I'll back it up here for a second. So with the cold, I have to describe that within the cell, you have a dam. It's called the mitochondria. People like to call it the powerhouse of the cell, but it's literally a reservoir. And you keep shoving in your food that you burn in there in terms of a hydrogen potential. And we, as a human being, have the ability to make now energy go through one side. We make little energy molecules that we can use in the cell. But if we wanted to, we can also shuttle this thing through an uncoupling protein, it's called, that allows you to generate heat. So if we're in this scenario, we're in this abundance and we're eating a lot, then exposure to cold is great because it allows you to move that massive dam that's getting pushed up too much, but it's about to spill. It might crack your dam and start leaking. You don't want that. Mm-hmm. And so the cold allows you to dissipate that potential and allows you to generate heat up. It does that on every single cell, whereas some animals, like I was mentioning before, they have it very restricted. But the human being, from skin to bone to connective tissue to muscle to nervous tissue, they all exhibit a certain amount of uncoupling protein. And I might be a little bit off on the nervous tissue. There might be only in like the supportive nervous tissue rather than the actual neurons. I would have to look it up. This is the wonderful thing about today is we have these databases of biological information in which have done the work. And this is why you can confidently say, we know this. We know that the human being has this expression pattern. And so on a hormonal level, cold does something that no other therapy or treatment does. Now, cold is also obviously the opposite of cold is the hot. Hot is a similar idea. It'll act a little differently in your system, but putting yourself in, for example, heat stress, like the sauna in which you're in there and now you're working with your heart rate, you've pushed past a little bit of your comfort zone and you're like, okay, I did good. My heart rate went up. I stayed with it. I worked and now I'm going to step out. Something different is going to happen, not the cold, but also beneficial. So the thermotherapy is like the fasting. It's not a negotiable if you want to heal yourself or if you want that resilient type of health. And individuals, when you say like, oh, you guys don't have cold. I'm sure in the evening, does it get cold in the evening where you guys are at, Naples?
Well, right. Well, honestly, in December, January, we felt a little bit of cold, but I wouldn't say it's
cold is a relative term. Yeah. It's not like your right. Pacific Northwest type of cold.
There's, yeah.
It's chilly.
I wouldn't even call it chilly. Chilly has been a different meaning to me for 25 years living over there in Vancouver.
But maybe that's what it means to rise with the sun. You know, if you're up at 5:30, and you're out in the elements, your body will experience a little bit of a different temperature than throughout the day.
Definitely.
You might move away. You might take that daytime nap. This is still, even without, having a cold bucket, a way to expose yourself. And often what you see is you see weird instances of where the farmer, which you wouldn't think that is good. This man has plowed the land and used his body like no other, and he's living to 100. And he's smoking a cigar on top. Like, this guy's breaking the mold. Let's talk to this gentleman here. What's going on? What's he doing right?
Yeah.
Okay.
So
it's more about putting your body through these shocks then rather than living somewhere cold, but actually these heat or cold shocks you're talking about.
Yeah. With, again, being kind to the biology. You know, if you did a minute today, do a minute in 5 seconds the next day, right? Don't go from zero to hero. Otherwise, you might have neural restriction. You might lose a little bit of sensation, right? Again, stress very much so, being kind to yourself, progressive, gradual progression, allow the body to adapt, allow the mind to adapt. Don't just be like, I'm a tough guy.
Yes. Okay. Absolutely. Okay.
Next pillar.
So the last pillar is digestion. And we were going to say exercise, but it's funny you touched on that. You're like, hey, walking's good enough. Because I was going to get into HIIT workouts and all these different kinds of amazing things that you read about. And you're like, oh my God, I got to incorporate that into my life. But walking's just enough.
I mean, it's enough. But remember, it does feel good to be able to ski at 80.
Yeah.
Or tennis. Tennis is another one. They've got to be sharp to the hand-eye coordination.
That actually is a high-intensity interval training, if you think about it.
Yes.
We actually took up tennis.
But let's focus on digestion before getting back into it. We'll have a couple of questions on exercise, but let's touch on digestion. It's interesting you call it digestion because your first pillar was diet, right? The first pillar was diet. The last one is digestion, which again is very interesting because last one was called digestion. So it's fascinating. I'm excited about this one because I feel that I've had some issues, digestive issues. I've gone and see gastrologists and tried all kinds of stuff. But it seems like there is something just not right the way that my body digests food, certain types of foods. I was great on keto, but then I was having some other issues. So this digestion is very fascinating. Please talk to us about it.
I mean, absolutely. It's a very simple observation that we have here is that in order to assimilate food, to take an apple or chickpea or lentil and be like, okay, I'm going to make this thing into Daniel. I'm going to make it into Daniel. You're going to make it into August. Ava's going to make it into Ava. We're all taking the same initial substrate as the starting point. And so we have to expend energy in order to be like, okay, well, I'm going to get a return on my investment. So every time I'm expending energy, there's a cost to it because I'm sending in what's like these molecular scissors to chop things up. And as I send in the molecular scissors to chop things up, sometimes inadvertently, like it chops up a little bit more than what I care for it to chop up. And so the pancreas is this organ that is always under a low grade of regeneration, because it is producing these proteolytic enzymes that act like scissors to break up your food. And so this part right away tells us like, okay, well, if you put something in that takes a lot of enzymes to break down, the person has to invest way more energy. And so it's like economics at the end of the day here. It's how much are you going to give out? Yes, you might get some back, but you have a limited tank now of what you can incorporate into yourself.
And like so peppers. Like hot peppers, I guess. That the first thing, as soon as you said that, I thought about like eating hot peppers because the nutrition you get is minimal, but the way that it puts your body through, it says a lot.
There's a special thing about capsaicin, cayenne pepper in particular, as acting as a blood stimulant. It's like one of my secret remedies for a lot of problems. So every single food might have a little different caveat. But if we're just thinking about pure basic of, hey, I need to assimilate things into my building blocks, digestion is expensive. And because we want to do it every day or most days, let's say out of the 365, at least 300 plus, it helps to add things to break things down before we've even ingested it. So my favorite, and I throw it almost on everything, is cumin. Cumin is a very easy digest. And also this is the same idea. Like I mentioned before, there's an old Indian lady. She's eating rice and lentils and then like a cabinet of 30 spices. What are those spices doing? And a big part, they're aiding and facilitating in the digestive process. And so a tiny amount of a liquor, like just a small amount, just a thimble, also acts as a digestive. It stimulates the liver to help facilitate digestive processes. And so this is another thing about dosages. Something can be very beneficial at a small dose and absolutely detrimental if you just go a tiny little bit over. And this is something that I think specifically in the North American part of the world has an issue with substance abuse. You know, the other parts of the world that have way better time with it. And I think it's because it's introduced to the children very early on. It's not held as taboo. It's there. It's observed. The person has it. Whereas in North America, there's this, oh, you're not allowed to drink to this age. Whereas when I was four, I asked to have a sip of beer. And the moment I drank it, I'm like, this is awful. This is absolutely terrible, right? Did anything bad happen to me? No, absolutely not. Same thing as a cigarette. That was my family's approach. I'm like, this thing is disgusting. How could you have
it? I never want this.
Right. And then you keep it away from that aside. I mean, topic aside, but that kind of comes to the point where that dosage is key. And things that are fermented foods are often like touted as, oh, they're super great. But yes, they have a different complete nutrient profile, the organic acids and things like that. But they also come pre-digested. That's another thing that's key for the health of us because it makes it easier for us to assimilate that food. The more that you aid your digestion, you'll notice how your sleep quota goes down. So that's the big part. And so this is why digestion takes such a high number up there. It might be almost up there, number one, or probably sleep would be number one. You can't go really well without sleep. But again, if you're not assimilating your food properly or not easily, you're going to have lots of issues. And there's another part that's kind of key to the fasting is that it gives the system a break to reset.
That's
you know,
right.
So if we send in things that we haven't been that in alignment with, because it's a little complicated as to why some groups can get away with eating certain foods and a lot of it, and other people can't, you know, a little bit, and they have problems. Beans are, I think, a wonderful choice for a lot of people, but sometimes they have to start with a really small amount and then gradually increase how much they have. Otherwise, they'll have massive bloating and problems. So I'll, like myself, never. Like, beans are like my favorite food in the weird way. Like, I think nothing satiates me more than kidney beans too. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, I guess that's the take-home message there is how everything you're cooking, can you incorporate this fenugreek, the cumins?
A little bit of sauerkraut perhaps before your meal.
Yeah, absolutely.
So I want to touch, not have you touched on the five pillars.
Yeah.
Let's talk about timeline sciences. Let's do an exercise. Let's say a client comes to you for their needs. I'm not sure if you help like vast groups of clients or individually, but let's just say for this exercise, an individual comes and sees you, for example, August.
Yours truly.
August Binyas comes in. He's got some digestive issues. He's got some, maybe a bit of fat around the belly. His sleep is not that great. Walk us through the journey that this person goes through and kind of the, and you don't have to, I mean, go over everything, but I'm assuming those five pillars is what you're going to use to have this patient or your client to see where they're there. But like, what would be your recommendations for this individual utilizing the five pillars of health that you told us about?
Yeah, absolutely. I do have to be very cautious with the word patient because there's a certain level of legality there, right? So it's a client.
Client.
I don't want to get targeted by any of the big pharmas.
Yes.
But, so what I do is I do exactly that. I work with the individual, right? So Timeline Sciences is present to walk you through your individual and unique timeline. That's the play on it. And I'm here to act as your scribe to put you through all the questions that you may or may not know to get you back on a healthy track. And so I do use, obviously, the pillars there to put a person on a timeline that's going to be thriving and healthy. But because there's just so much of it, it always comes off as personalized as possible. And what I see as the most relevant piece of information that person can take, summate, transform within the next little time period, whether it's a week, a two, and then come back and begin to incorporate more and more and more.
It doesn't necessarily mean that everybody who comes and sees you, they're going to be advised, or again, the right legal term to use, a prescriber advised or salted to then do cold plunges. It doesn't necessarily mean you're just going to see, because if it's part of your pillar, doesn't that mean everybody should do some cold plunge or a cold shock?
Yeah.
I'm not sure how to call it, but doesn't that mean everybody should, or do you still select who should do it?
Yeah, so it's a great, very fair question. I 100% select when and who should do it. It's not that everyone should just go away, hey, go into cold, because if you're in a fragile state, I would obviously not recommend that you go into the cold. You're not ready for the cold. And so, for example, for a gentleman who pretty much did all the work, he came to me at about 80% where he dealt with his lupus. Okay, so lupus, he got like a bad diagnosis, terrible set of news, and he was kind of left to his devices, be like, no, you're stuck with this for the rest of your life. And he's a stubborn man. He's just like, no, I'll deal with it. I'm going to go and pretty much change my entire life. I will fix this. And he did. And at about 80% where he had no more problems, he had no more flare-ups, no issues, he met me. And I told him, well, this has got to talking. And I was fascinated of what he'd done. Pretty much treated his diet as if it's the most restrictive thing ever. Brought it back down to basics. Slowly started introducing things. Realized, anytime I have ice cream, problems. I'm not allowed to touch ice cream. And so I gave him my protocol for cold, how to go about it, how to do it. And he took it up religiously.
So when somebody gets to a stable situation, that all those five pillars are incorporated, including the cold. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, that'd be fair. Yeah. I mean, when you're in a stable situation and you're looking for more, then you are incorporating all those,
fasting,
all those five pillars.
Or fasting, for example. Yeah. Somebody is agile, you're not going to put them on a three-day fast, right?
3-day for sure, no. But 100% put them right away on what people call intermittent fasting, which
really
I would say is not intermittent fasting. I say intermittent fasting is another word for saying like, basic default way of living as a human being, respectful to your physiology.
The way I understand intermittent fasting is that what's happening is your body, it's actually the good cells start eating up the weak cells. Is that correct? Because your body's actually having time to digest everything.
Yeah. I mean, it's not necessarily the weak cells, but what happens is same way a leaf withers, a cell will wither.
Yes.
And now will an immune cell come by and gobble it up or not is an important, let's say, consequence to us on this gross anatomical level. We don't want these senescent cells hanging around.
Yeah.
If you're constantly eating, pretty much the immune cell can't get the signal to do its work.
That's right.
So it won't eat the cell. And not only that, but the cells on the inside, if you're constantly eating, don't get the signal to do their own cleaning process, right? This process of autophagy, right? And autophagy, auto, like, is regards to the self. And then phagy is this eating process, right? Yeah. It's the, like, their term for the phagocyte is the macrophage that comes in and gobbles it up. And so if we're in a constant state of eating, if we're eating from like 8 o'clock, you wake up right away, food and snacks, lunch, you know, snacks, dinner, you're eating snacks up until you go to bed. There's no time for the metabolism to shift from assimilation and nutrient absorption into detoxification, autophagy, reparative, regenerative processes.
That's right. You can never activate autophagy, meaning that the self-eating or self-devouring, it never happens.
And the consequences are exactly that. Like, you're going to come with advanced aging, it's going to come faster, and you're going to have a lot more problems a lot earlier on. And so in North America, from what I've got to see in terms of data sets, 55 is this age where it manifests for, did someone do the right things or not? And it's really hard to, once you've been hit with the aging stick, to reverse it all, because you lose, for example, hepatic, your liver mass. You simply lose a portion of it. It's not trivial now to re-stimulate it to go, because all these niches within our body are depleted.
What age is that, Daniel?
So 55 for the person that's not doing so good, right? But I also have 80-year-olds that have a blood profile of a 30-year-old.
Right.
Wow.
In which case, they've done phenomenal.
Right? Wow.
When a client comes and sees you, what kind of tests do you do? Like DNA tests, blood testing? What is a test that you need to figure more about?
Yeah, so what Timeline Sciences is, it's my way of offering a service to connect you with science. And so you can bring me any molecular test that's today on the planet. And what I will do is I will evaluate that molecular test and try to communicate to you what that means for you. So there's a lot of companies and they have great products and they have to be very reserved in liability with their algorithms. And so their algorithm is, you have about a 51 to 60% chance that it might be appropriate for you. And so what if you're relying on that 40%? Or maybe sometimes they have a really easy one. So maybe it's like 90%. Okay, sure. Even that. So in these biological ages and these genetic tests, there hasn't been any easy access for people to be like, well, I want to talk to someone about this. And so I do advocate, if you want to come talk to me, we can just even go through the health aspect of it. We can go through a consulting of science if there's something more nitty gritty, whether you're looking for targets. And then if you'd like me to analyze data, that's another service I offer. If you don't know what data to get, then you come see me and then we talk about what one you might want to get. So if you have a gastro condition, whether you have a joint condition, whether you have a neural condition, there's different blood panels you can get that might help you get information of what you can do in terms of lifestyle, in terms of nutrition, in terms of these different healing modalities that you can participate in.
Yeah. I think the most fascinating thing about all this is that you can actually reverse your biological age. So it's not too late, right? For everybody listening.
Yeah.
To reverse biological
so that gets to my kind of next question here is really about the blue zones or centenarians or people living up to be 150 years old. Peter Thiel, I think, is one of the first investors of Facebook, is talking about living to be 150. Mm-hmm. If money wasn't a consideration, if a client came to you and said they have, let's say, a billionaire, one of these billionaires who are trying to live forever, all the power to them, because we'll learn from what they do. And it's always the super wealthy that try things, experiment with things, and then us everyday people get to use those things. So if somebody came to you, money wasn't an issue, and they could throw as much money as possible to their head, and they're somewhat healthy, they're somewhat middle-aged, between 40 and 60 years old, or let's say that 55 mark, they're between 40 and 55, what would be your main recommendation? Again, money is not an issue here. What would be your recommendation there?
I mean, if they're trying to be the frontier, then they'd have to have an idea of what is it on the molecular sense that is the biggest driver for aging. And so if a billionaire was to go about it, really the take home isn't the nutrients. The reality is this, the better you are at playing, I don't eat. And then you're able to, with a tiny little drop, scavenge 100% of that material, a lot more efficient system than a system that constantly needs, oh, I need to see this, you know, nutrient every single day.
Wow. Incredible.
So that would be the component that I have to strive for, is like, this is the obvious evidence. First, we have to address the elephant in the room. The second one, the one that seems to be tied in with like the ancient sort of wisdoms that's been passed down, as well as the evidence that's always coming back up, is this ability for the body to use oxygen and not do damage to itself. So as we make that dam-like hydrogen potential that we have to generate energy, oxygen to the air is the acceptor. So when you breathe in, you breathe in oxygen, you breathe out carbon dioxide. And that's not the same oxygen, right? That oxygen is going in and is getting converted into water, right? The carbon dioxide is from the food. It's kind of ridiculous that the fact that you're taking gases and you as the living being is making a different element of water, right? And so the way that we use oxygen ends up burning up the system itself, where when we think, okay, aging is happening, why does the cell need to eat itself? Is because there is oxidation processes that start stripping electrons and little bits away from its surroundings. And so we have to constantly do this upkeep of DNA protection, DNA protection enzymes. So we have these enzymes that function, superoxide dismutase, that function to burden this antioxidant stress. We have sensors that function on this very cusp of antioxidant detection, NAD, if you guys heard NAD plus. And so if you can train your system to be extremely efficient or competent at utilizing oxygen, and then kind of who do we look to for that? Well, like you see the athlete's doing good on a cellular level, but they don't do good on a physiological level. They end up getting strokes and cardiac problems, and you know, the athletes don't live as long, but their cells look phenomenal. So when you have individuals that are very active, that are very in line with, they've done something in their life, maybe they're climbing constantly mountains, they live in mountainside, and that's, for example, like in the Hunza Valley, that's not part of the Bloom Zones. Blue zones are cool because they've, you know, brought some attention to, hey, these people are doing something right. But there's plenty of other places on the planet where people have made it quite far. And often it is in the mountainous valleys that end up being very prosperous for longevity. And so that would be if a billionaire came and be like, okay, well, you're on the frontier. Let's spend the money. Let's get the technology. And obviously what we'd want is we want to bring in the science as best we can so that it gives us knowledge. So we're not believing in things that we're going based off of what we know. And that's what science can do for you, right? And so the more we have in terms of technology that allows us to give insight into what's happening on the inside, then we can make those decisions to keep that inside of a particular way and make adjustments along the way. What I offer is this new age revolutionary preemptive approach. Nice. And the preemptive approach is you get the blood test when you're healthy, right? And there's a lot more in the blood than just, you know, your cholesterol. And so this is why I think these proteomic metabolomic panels are so good to get when you're in a healthy state. Because Now when you're in a healthy state, I think there's something very important to simply be said, that there is no better control than yourself, right? And in science, you know, the first pillar of science is you make an observation and then you got to write it down some way to communicate it. You get a knowledge. Next one is you got to take a measurement, right? And that's going to be your evidence, right? That's what's testable. And if you don't have a control, meaning a value to compare to, a control value to compare to, your measurements are useless. Mm-hmm. And now, yes, you can compare from one person to the other. That's obviously very great and dandy. We can do that. And we just do that. It's useful. But when it comes to you and your individual health, like in order to compare a brain, we need 300 average brains, right? We need to average 300 brains so that you can compare one brain to another. And so this goes to show that if you have your blood test at age 30, at age 35, at age 40, at age 45, and then at age 60, something happens. Well, you have decades worth of information of what's going on. And somebody can come in and really scare you into a bad protocol or bad treatment or bad decisions based off a test that's not very good. Like D-dimer, for example. D-dimer for a clotting factor. That thing will go up if you go up a flight of stairs too fast. Yeah, you'll get injected with an anticoagulant ASAP if that thing is high. All of a sudden, they're rushing to get anticoagulants in there, right? So there's an importance there in having that information for yourself, because sure, it costs a couple $100 to get that blood panel. That investment pays for itself quadruple, if not unsurmountable amount more, because it gives you that knowledge to be able to work in the future, right? And so this is where I think the preemptive approach is going to become a cultural mind shift, so that people are getting it as something that they're very excited about, that they want to know, rather than, I'll get it. I'll let medicines help me when the problems come.
Danny, we could talk to you all day long. We've just got a couple of more questions here before we get to the next segment of our show, but we're going to definitely bring you back to talk about more items here. Really fascinating stuff. But
one question I really want to dive into is genetics versus lifestyle. Okay, so there's often a debate about genetics versus lifestyle when it comes to longevity. How much do our genes determine our lifespan, and to what extent can lifestyle choices override that genetic disposition?
Yeah, to be honest, I've met some people that genetically, they did not look good. I'm like, God, you were not dealt a good hand with genetics. They just look frail. And then you see some people in their specimen, you're like, wow, this person, you can just tell they're going to live forever. And then you got everybody in between. But yeah, talk to us about, is it just a fallacy, this idea of genes and born with it, or the way that we live our lives? But I guess in a way that the way our brains are formed as well, right? So maybe physically we're not formed the best, but our brain helps us not be more structured and not have sugar cravings. And then you might end up living longer, even though you were frail or what have you. So yeah, talk to us about that.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, good news and bad news. So if the good news is if you like self-responsibility, then great. If you want to scapegoat with genetics, I don't have good news for you. I mean, two classes for genetics. There's clear inborn errors of metabolism, they're called. And for those individuals, it's a massive truncation of life, right? So you can have like the most, let's say the most severe of the genetic components is a disease called progeria. And it's fascinating because it's just one nucleotide, meaning it's just one little, call it a code in the DNA, and you have the most devastating advanced aging disease that we know of. And so if we exclude all the clearly easy to identify genetic ones and you become an adult, that's about 95% of the planet. So about 95% of people have a complete genome that lets you do all the superpowers that come along with the genome, the growth hormones, the insulins, everything. And the way you use your genome, the way you get to know yourself, is the determining factor of how long and how well you will live. So did you at some point in time push your cardiovascular system and develop a high VO2 max? It's okay if it came down later in life, but did you ever do it? You didn't? Okay, well, you didn't get the benefits of it then. Did you at any point in time put yourself through a very, say, mental strenuous lifestyle, meaning you had to take on a lot, be busy, know how to compartmentalize things, deal with emotions? You didn't? Okay, well, you don't get the benefits of that. There's this skill in living as a human being. And again, it's tied in with these signals that keep coming back to you. For me, looking like this and being healthy, it's not so much an option. It's just that I'm super sensitive. And so if I don't do the stretching and the exercise that I do, I start getting pains everywhere. And so, you know, you can say, oh, he's genetic. Look at him. He's a genetic specimen. Like, yeah, but my genetics problems keep coming up everywhere. Right.
Yeah, you guys are seeing Daniel with his shirt on. We usually go to the pool and cold plunge and the guy is ripped. So yeah, keep going.
That's right.
I'm happy to do it as an example. I take myself as a little bit of an experiment where I recognize how much of a monkey I am. I'll put M&Ms beside me. I don't eat M&Ms anymore, but this is back when I was dealing with the sugar, and I'll put nuts just out of reach. You're there, you're working, you're doing your thing, and it's easy. You're just there. And then next week I move the M&Ms away and I put the nuts there, and it's just, right? So there's a level of coming to terms with understanding how much of the biology does play a role in ruling us. And that kind of goes to, you know, another question is, what is the you that's kind of piloting or doing the biology, where you can play this introspective portion? I think this is the what it means to live a human life. You're not just an organism, a creature that's ruling around. You're being, and you get to choose very much so how you're being on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely.
Amazing. Amazing. We want to talk to you about a bunch of other things, but we'll do it for another show. Oh yeah, last topic. I mean, this is a very interesting topic. I mean, we are good friends with Daniel's brother, George. He's great friends. He's even visited us here in Florida. But there's a topic me and him have discussed, as this idea of, I mean, let's talk about sex, right? I mean, it's part of our lives as human beings. I mean, that's how we reproduce. It's a very enjoyable part of life as well. But there's this kind of concept of preserving orgasm, particularly for males, as some kind of a way to, again, health and longevity. The time that I was introduced to this concept was in boxing, where a lot of pro boxers, they go into training camp 3 months before their fight in most cases. And a lot of times they actually don't have their wives or girlfriends nearby, and their abstinence from sex and preserving themselves for the fight on the field, they're much more stronger and powerful for the fight. But some people say that's not the case. And some boxers actually have sex the same day before the fight, because that calms them down, and they've been great as well. But talk to us about this, and I'm not saying the term correctly either. You might have the better scientific term for it, but kind of preserving yourself from orgasm. I'm not sure what it's called.
Semen retention is the term that's floating around to highlight that.
Got it.
And we can separate that right away from semen retention and orgasm, because the male is capable of having an orgasm without ejaculating.
Okay.
So that's good news. It does take skill. The man has to practice and has to work towards getting to the orgasm and then holding the sensation so that the ejaculate passes. Once that signal passes, then you can continue experiencing and enjoying the orgasm without ever losing the semen.
Interesting.
And so that's good news if someone cares to practice it. Otherwise, you know, simply just don't have it. And I do think there's very much a lot of accuracy to this. There's accuracy to this because not only is the current evidence showcasing it for the cognitive aspect of how a person is sharper, that the longer that they've gone without it or ejaculating, that they're sharper and very much so in a cognitive testable way. The other aspect to it too is it's a very tract of resources. You're just like digestion, sperm is very heavy intensive in terms of minerals and resource content. And so if every single day you're ejaculating, your body has to constantly keep sending and shuttling resources down to the area to be able to keep doing this process. And the part that I think is always in importance is to take a look at what our ancestors have left for us in terms of knowledge. And both Chinese and Indian, we'll call it mythos or their text, they've given this. They both have words for this type of energy that's associated to kidneys and nervous system as it relates to man's semen retention. And it's extremely detailed, where it goes to the point of saying, for the young man in his 20s, he can do it every other day. Man in his 30s, he has to wait about, and I might be messing up the days here, but it's a general trend. As you get older, you're allowed less and less. So somewhere around your 50s, 60s, like you're ejaculating once a month to twice a month max, something along those lines, in terms of it not burdening the system and causing you to drain too much of this particular energy that they're talking about. So, I mean, for all the men out there that have a very ferocious female that they need to satisfy, they need to figure out how to not ejaculate and have the orgasm if they want to continue having fun with their ladies. Because the ladies are in a different boat altogether. Yes. They get the pleasure of having the orgasms without the consequence of the loss of a very, very critical, let's say, resource that the body needs to produce.
Got it. So overall, for a healthy male kind of lifestyle, that semen retention should be part of that exercise if you're living more on that supreme being type of lifestyle for a man, in your opinion.
Absolutely. And I do think there's a reason why it's in so many of the religious texts, right? It's not there on just like a hey and a whim, by the way, don't do it. It's there as a biological representation of if you're constantly doing it, there's a detriment. There's a tax that you're going to have to pay, the human tax. You got to appreciate and respect the biology there, right? Not enable the compulsion.
Yes.
I deal with the compulsion. I think a lot of young men, maybe even the older ones, but I know that a lot of young men are fighting that compulsion with the easy access to it today.
Amazing, man. What a fascinating conversation.
Yeah. Hey, thanks, guys.
I could be here.
I could talk to you all night about this.
But let's get to the next segment of our show. And yeah, please.
Let's do this. Okay, Daniel, it's called the 10 Championship Rounds to Financial Freedom.
Cool.
All right. So whatever comes top of mind, are you ready?
Hit me.
Okay, here we go. First question. Who's been the most influential person in your life?
I mean, it's clearly my brother. Man, the amount of like the joy and the frustration, it's just, there's no other person on the planet that can. It's got to be my brother.
Amazing.
He's an amazing guy.
Yeah.
Very, very grateful I have a brother, right? I call him my younger brother because the way he behaves.
That's awesome. We all love George. All right, next question. What is the number one book you would recommend?
I mean, if just on health in particular, I guess I'll take a step back. My number one book I recommend, this is often a gift I give people, is The Hermetic Principles. And it's a fantastic book. If you wanted to know about science without ever having to do years of science, having the Hermetic Principles is, I would say, better.
Okay, Daniel, next question. If you had the opportunity to travel back in time, what advice would you give your younger self?
Stop thinking so much. It's just, you're overthinking it. It's do something else. Do, right? And I think that's a big part of your mental well-being is doing, right? So I like swimming in the cold water with my dog. I'm not thinking. I'm very much so, oh my God, it's cold.
Nice.
Maybe you could switch up the next question and
Sure. Make
it more an investment to your body and health?
Yeah.
Possibly?
I love that. Okay. So this is a question we always ask. What's the best investment you've ever made? But what's the best investment you've ever made for your
health and body
and mind?
Longevity.
Yeah. Yeah. By far, it's been adopting breathing exercise, like treating breathing as an exercise.
Oh, wow.
Wow. And
the more breathing exercises I've done, the more I've realized I can get access to parts of my body. And so there's this idea, there's this subtle energy of breathing. I can't communicate to you this subtle energy, but I can tell you what my progression was towards it. And for some of the subtle energies, it took me like 8 years to finally feel it, where I didn't have to muscularly push through it, where I just very calmly, very easily can now go into that area of my body. And by doing so, I can, for example, completely alleviate any congestion in my nose.
Wow.
That was just the fact that I kept exploring, kept pushing into this breath work. It was like my homework.
Incredible.
I love
incredible.
That. Okay.
So the same thing on the reverse side.
Same thing. So what's the worst investment you've ever made in your health?
No, but maybe not an investment. But yeah. But worst you've ever done to your health or longevity.
Well, I mean, it's got to be this thing, right?
Wow. Yes.
Oh, the phone.
Yes.
You know what? We're at something like a billion, if not a trillion X, the amount of radiation that our grandparents were exposed to.
Yeah.
And so I love information. I love technology. I love learning. I love being in the forefront of things. And it's taken way more nights of sleep than it should. I just stay on it. I stay connected. And the times where I disconnect and I do the proper living, or treating myself like a human being, is always rewarded. And so the technology has been something that I personally, I still work today to draw healthy boundaries And often I get overwhelmed with how much I've taken on and that my health will, and it suffers at the end, right? It's not like I'm perfect by any means.
Yeah. No, we hear you. Yeah. All right. Yeah. The next question, we can just have it for fun if you want.
Yeah. How much would you need in the bank to retire today? What's your number?
It doesn't matter how much money in the bank. I'm always going to work.
Amazing.
Nice.
Amazing.
Love it. Okay. Next question, Daniel. If you could have dinner with someone dead or alive, who would it be?
Leonardo da Vinci. I mean, he had so much nuance to what he saw before his time. What he left in terms of writings is fascinating, and the insights. I mean, also the works he did, from anatomy to painting. I mean, just the anatomy alone, I could sit and talk to him about. Be a blast.
Incredible.
Nice.
Incredible.
All right, next question. If you weren't doing what you're doing today, what would you be doing now?
I'd be an engineer, for sure. Way easier. The biology was a mistake. It's way too hard. At least in the day with engineering, I have a product. I'm happy with it. And I can leave the...
Yes.
Well, at least you're helping a lot of people.
Yes.
You know what I mean? There's nothing like that.
I think this is an important question. Even in academia and research and science, sometimes people get really fixated on intricacies, and sometimes people just get things going. Even in the world of science, being a go-getter is really helpful. But maybe this is a great question. Next question, Ava.
All right, Daniel, book smarts or street smarts?
Without a doubt, 100% street smarts. I've had people come into the laboratory where they're geniuses on paper and they can't do the most simple protocol. Well, they just get flustered and attempt four, you're like, yeah, he'll get it this time. They still, and you can bring someone in that has absolutely no clue of anything that he's doing. Give him the protocol, show him how to use a pipette. And within try one, he's already knocked it out of the park.
And this is coming from a scientist, guys.
Yes.
All right.
It's easier to teach the book than it is the street. Let's put it that way. So if you have the street, the book is always there.
Yes. Right. Yes.
Okay, Daniel, last question. Okay. If you had $1 million in cash and you had to make one investment today, what would it be?
I'm going to say real estate just because I'm on the real estate.
Oh, no. It'd probably be your company, right? You'd probably be missing
in timeline.
No, I mean, that's going in the direction it's going. I generally would put it into real estate without any bit of facetiousness.
Yes,
because for me, stuck behind a computer and working remotely for the time being, which is wonderful. But I can't wait to grow some food. I can't wait to have a wall of green beans. That's what I'm looking forward to. As my goal of something that keeps me trekking forward is I want that plot of land.
Yeah.
I want to manage my soil, good for the fun soil science of it. And I want to grow my vegetables.
Amazing.
Right? Nothing commercial or anything. I just want to have some for myself and my community. It's not like I'm going to grow a bunch of things, but you can't do that unless you have the real estate.
And that's
so
true. That's true.
There's also peace of mind to be able to come home, sit, and just be like, I'm home. This is my little spot, right? Nice. And then you make that paradise, right? So absolutely.
Amazing. Awesome, man. Really appreciate you being here today.
Really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
We're going to definitely have you back. We're going to have you back, definitely.
Yes. Daniel, just let the viewers know the best way that they can reach you, please.
For your viewers, I'll give you guys the easiest way to access me, which is Daniel Taushan, my name, nothing between, at proton.me. All right. I will check that email. You will get a response from me if you message me through that very specifically for your audience. Otherwise, timelinesciences.com. The website will go through some iterations as I get help as a scientist, business side of things, as I'm learning that. But timelinescience.com, if you go to the contact page, you can contact me directly. Right.
Amazing.
Amazing. Thanks, Daniel.
Thank you, Daniel.
You're a big value add.
Thank you, guys. So thank you, guys.
Thank you for joining us for this episode. We hope this conversation enlightened you on how to win big in this highly profitable and risk-averse space. Get on your feet and embrace this world that offers so many opportunities just waiting for you out there. Continue your journey to becoming a savvy real estate expert by subscribing to the show at cpicapital.ca. Don't forget to leave a positive rating and share with your friends. See you on the next one.